Yeah.
Please. Well, I want to welcome everyone. This is day two, for some of you day one, which is perfectly great. And I'm Rick Hansen. Just kind of briefly here, I'm professionally I'm a psychologist, and for the last many years I've been very interested in writing and teaching about many things. So after our family had children, our kids are 19 and 21, I got very interested in what happens to mothers, or what happens to women when they have kids, and also to couples that have kids. So I ended up out of that, partly to survive the transition to parenthood and my wife's significant depletion as a result. I wrote a book for Penguin 2002 called Mother Nurture, which continues to be remarkably the only book that really addresses the long-term health and well-being of mothers and couples after kids come along. There are a lot of books for the postpartum period or kind of laments or memoirs of motherhood, but nobody just sat down and said, okay, how do we really think about this? Clearly, you know, body, mind, and intimate relationships. So that was a chapter in my life. And then I got very, very interested in the brain about the last 10 years, especially the last five. My own Dharma practice began in 1974 with an introduction to Zen, mainly, and it just seemed to be completely, profoundly true, and also Vedanta, more of a non-dual perspective. And those two threads have been very central for me. I've been involved with Spirit Rock for about 15 years. I was on their board for 9 years, just finished up recently, and I teach there day-longs and other things there. And then I also teach elsewhere, and I'm on a trajectory where that's happening. My book, Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom, catchy subtitle, maybe, maybe not. But anyway, it's going to come out November 1st, which is great, and there's a little flyer about it over there. And some of what we're going to do here will be in that book. I'm also recording these day-longs, and we'll post these talks and conversations we have on our website, wisebrain.org. I founded a nonprofit institute about 2.5 years ago called the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom, and it just offers a lot out into the world. So the articles related to a lot of our topics today, talks and things like that, are very freely available there. So even though we're really going to get into a lot of the deep end of the pool. Is there really any water there? But anyway, we're going to go into the deep end of the pool. You know, is there a spoon? I always think about that. There is really no spoon, but, you know, in a sense. So you're very welcome to go to those resources on your own and just use and pass along as you like whatever's freely offered there, whatever's there. Okay. So I want to very briefly recap a couple of sort of themes or suggestions from yesterday, and then begin this morning with a meditation where, on your own, I invite you to pursue those themes. And then on that basis, we'll get into the major topic today, which is no self in the brain. In other words, to kind of preview that subject, it is said that perhaps the most radical and innovative teaching of the Buddha 2,500 years ago was related to what is sometimes called emptiness, which is fundamentally the observation, which is very consistent with modern ecology and physics, that everything is connected to everything else. And therefore, nothing has an absolute existence in its own right. Now, that observation is pretty easy to swallow when you think of something like a snowflake or a bubble or a butterfly. It's harder to swallow when we apply that insight to that very persistent sense that I really am a me. I really am a self-arising, self-existent, independent being, the subject of experience, the agent of action. That's me. Are you talking to me? Yeah? Do you love me? Will I die? It's incredibly personal. So a subject that may seem philosophical and heady is actually right where we live, because it's right at, are you talking to me? You know, who am I? The perennial question. So that's what we'll engage today. And try to ground that engagement and inform it in the body and especially the brain, which is actually a very useful window into this subject, which can get very... But if you really kind of ground it in what's actually happening in the nervous system as self arises, increases, decreases, shifts around, or as, to put it a little differently, as selfing occurs as a process, understanding something of what's going on in the nervous system as that occurs is actually really informative and useful. And so that's what we'll be exploring today. Okay. So, in terms of that, just to repeat briefly for those of you who weren't here, we'll take a break in the morning, we'll have a lunch break, we'll take a break in the afternoon. It's okay to get up, even not during the break, and get some water, use the bathroom, it's really okay. It's okay to get up, stretch, be comfortable. In other words, to preview an important theme, while you may not be a self, you certainly are a person. And as we are called to be compassionate and kind to all beings, in other words, to wish and to help all beings neither not suffer and also that they be happy, we're one of those all beings. You know, one of those beings has your name tag on it. You know, to be kind and compassionate to that being that you are. So that is a theme today as well in terms of how you approach this material and take care of your body and your being today. So we'll end quite close to 4, if not perhaps even exactly at 4. I live in San Rafael, which is north of San Francisco, so I have a little drive ahead of me at the end of the day, so I'll tend to leave fairly briskly after 4. If you'd like to contact me via email, you're welcome to do that. I invite you to give me your email address, which I'll take good care of, and then put you on the subscription list for the monthly Wise Brain Bulletin, which you can always get off that subscription list. And every so often, I'll let you know about other things, too, other offerings. Sometimes I send out information, things like that. So if you want to contact me that way, you're really invited to do that. Okay? That's kind of the plan for today. All right. So I personally love this subject, you know, because it's great. Okay, so let's, in a moment, sit. And I want to reprise the suggestions that I made yesterday that are sort of neuro-savvy, brain-savvy suggestions for really steadying the mind. And so this is kind of a recap. And I won't do this as a guided meditation. I'll just name these right now, and then we'll do a sit for probably half an hour, 40 minutes or so. So it'll be a fairly long sit. If you want to walk around during it, because that's how you concentrate better, you're welcome to walk over there quietly. Just do whatever works for you. So if we want to help the mind be steady, there's certain skillful things to do to help the brain be steady. Because one of the fundamental notions from yesterday was that the mind and brain co-arise. And that, in other words, as the brain changes, as your brain changes, your mind changes. As my brain changes, my mind changes. As the mind changes, the brain changes. And the brain changes both momentarily and in enduring ways, particularly with repetition of mental activity, for better or for worse. So negative mental activity leaves enduring negative neural structures, negative in the sense that they create negative results. Positive mental activity leaves positive enduring neural structures in terms of their results. So that goes to a real sense of stewardship. And you know, householder practice is directed at the household of the brain, the household of the mind. We want to keep our household clean as householders, right? And so it really makes a difference what we experience moment to moment. So we're going to be doing, I mean, I encourage you, if you like, to kind of follow some brain savvy suggestions for mental activity to really help the mind be stable and steady. So now I'm going to name them kind of quickly. And if you're new here, it's really okay to remember these or write them down or ignore them. So, 5 foundational practices. Number 1, set an intention, okay, unless the frontal lobes. 2, relax. Relax the body. Exhale, relax. Three, to the extent you can, help yourself feel into a growing sense of safety. Not absolute or perfect safety, that's impossible actually in this life, but a greater, relatively greater sense of safety so that you can relax vigilance, the incredible hair trigger of threat reactivity in the brain is soothed and dampened, and you can bring attention inward for inner work. You can bring the sentinels in from the battlements, scanning for threats, and put them to rest or put them to work inside. That's safety. Fourth, really cultivate positive emotion. Happiness is skillful means. It's a very strong theme. It's really okay to open to invite, and kindle, and intensify positive states of mind, particularly happiness, or quite mild states often, like gratitude, or contentment, or tranquility, and to gently encourage them. There's a middle way here where we're not striving after those states, but we're encouraging them, opening to them, and through mindfulness, actually helping ourselves stay with them and not be distracted into a more typical negative preoccupation. That's the fourth suggestion. Fifth, really help what's being experienced in these positive moments really sink in to what's called implicit memory, not memory for events. That's called, you know, recollection or episodic memory, but most of memory is implicit. It's in our bones, it's in our guts. We feel it, but we don't recall the specific episodes. But implicit memory is the part of the iceberg that's below the waterline. And because we evolved to be very attentive to negative experiences, the brain has a negativity bias toward recalling and storing and reacting to negative experience. So it's really important to emphasize positive experience. So when you're having a positive experience, when you're sitting, really, really soak that in. Feel like it's sinking into you, like water into a sponge, warm cocoa cup into your hands on a cold day. It's sinking in. So those are the five foundation suggestions. Set an intention, relax, growing sense of safety, positive emotion, sinking in, taking in the good. Okay? Then on the basis of that, we followed the roadmap of the Buddha, in which he said, one is to steady the mind internally, quiet it, and then bring it to singleness. And on the basis of that, tip into a very, very deep state of mind. So I offered a number of suggestions yesterday about moving through those steps. Steadying the mind, one way to do that is to pick an object like the breath, and that's the one I'll use. You're welcome to use something different. A common alternative object to ground attention in or to become absorbed in. You're going after absorption when you're steadying the mind. A common alternative is a metta phrase, a loving kindness phrase like, may all beings be happy, or may I be healthy, or may I live with ease. You know, may my pet live with ease, something like that. Whatever works for you, or a mantra, you know, or a saying, or just a felt sense of, you know, something wonderful. But you're dwelling on that. So when you're trying to steady the mind, that first step, you pick something and you just go into it. You apply attention to it, and then you sustain attention to it. A nice metaphor for each breath is that we're with the breath like an ice skater. So when we apply attention to each inhalation and each exhalation, we apply attention at the beginning like an ice skater planting her shoe. And then we sustain attention to the inhalation or exhalation like an ice skater gliding along the surface of the ice. And at the end, we plant and we sustain again, over and over and over again. If the mind wanders at all, we are renunciates during this meditation. We drop it and we come back to the object. What's nice about concentration practices is they're very simple. You know what you're supposed to do. You know what I mean? It's very simple. Are you on the breath? Or whatever your object is, and I'll just from now on talk about the breath. Are you on the breath or off the breath? If you're on the breath, good. If you're off the breath, come back to the breath. You know, and renounce anything else. Support a growing disenchantment with anything else that beguiles the mind that you want to chase after or struggle with. You're dropping those mind objects, you're coming back to the breath. And you're going into the sensations of the breath, felt wherever it is. That's how you're steadying the mind. As you do that, you're increasingly disengaging from verbal thought. You're allowing the mind to become increasingly quiet. pursuing tranquility is really good, not in the sense of chasing it, but encouraging it and valuing or growing tranquility. Like a mountain pond that becomes perfectly still, you know, undisturbed by the least breath of air. Okay. And then on the basis of that steadying and quieting, and you're going to do this in your own way, I'm not going to give instructions during this meditation, just go after it yourself. One nice entryway that you might explore, and different things work for different people, very important point, just do what works for you. But one thing to explore is a sense of your body as a whole. Good. In other words, we often, attention tends to skitter from point to point to point to point, or thought to thought to thought. It's a different thing to just try to get a sense of being a body as a whole, breathing here, just sitting. You know, Zen Shikantaza, just sitting. Nowhere to go, nothing to do, no one to be. Just sitting. Just being a body breathing, settling ever more deeply into that experience. And as a whole body, that activates the right hemisphere and also tends to inhibit verbal activity, which really supports quiet. And it also supports the third step, coming to singleness, which is a state of mind characterized by great quiet, equanimity, so there's not reactivity to whatever arises, there's not chasing the pleasant or resisting the unpleasant. It's characterized as well by what's called unification of awareness, where everything seems to kind of come together as one whole stable thing, and it's characterized by one-pointedness, where there's a deep involvement in the object of attention that feels increasingly effortless. You're just kind of glued in a lovely way or gravitationally drawn to the object of attention. An emotional quality of warm-heartedness to the object really helps too. Fondness for the breath, devotion to the breath, you know, tipping into the pleasure, the bliss of this. Looking for the factors of rapture or bliss in the body, as well as looking for happiness. You know, happiness is on a spectrum of happiness, contentment, and tranquility. Okay, pursuing those factors, starting with happiness and then moving into contentment and then deep tranquility, is a real doorway into coming to singleness. All right. I don't expect you to remember all that. That was a tight summary of a lot of yesterday. But those are good, skillful means, you know, to go into a steadiness of mind. Any question about that before we sit? Okay. Okay, so let's sit. So find a comfortable posture, one that promotes alertness and relaxation. In a concentration practice, pain is usually not helpful, so you want to be comfortable. It's okay to scratch or to move or to stand or even to get around, walk around. It's okay to sort of increase the muscularity of your application and then decrease it in a kind of rhythm. You know, kind of like working, lift, you lift it and then you relax. That's really okay. And throughout, an attitude of kindness toward yourself, where you're on your own side, you know, like a gently encouraging grandparent who really loves you, but you know, has had it with your nonsense, the nonsense of the mind, and keeps coming back to what works. So, let's begin.
Get the amplifier for now. Prepare it and have a break.
I'll use natural amplification, my camp counselor voice. Get out of the pool. So, okay. I think it might help my aging eyes if one of those lights were on, like the middle one. We had that on yesterday, if that's okay. Maybe not. Maybe my eyes are not alone. And then maybe we could get the projector on. Do we push a switch or... Do you know my chest? Thank you.
How many people do not have a handout?
Christine.
I do.
Mm-hmm.
One, two, three.
Actually, I think I
have one of the same handout as yesterday.
Is it the same?
Yeah, that's
the
right.
Same as yesterday.
Oh.
If you have yesterday. So how many people do not have a handout? Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Because at the break, we could probably print some up for just today's because it's a lot fewer pages. So you'll have it to take notes on.
Great.
But it's projected, too. So.
Yeah, and we may need to, you know?
Oh, well,
I could leave that off. How about we turn that off?
How about
put that
one
on?
Okay.
With the black looks okay.
You guys decide. Is that okay?
Yeah, how about this one is for the
this light is on.
Well, it's these two or that one. Those are the choices.
I can live without the lights if you can.
Yeah, I like
that's better.
It's kind of cozy,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
No light.
That's
no light.
A little campfire, very consistent with the setting. A little, you know, tribal. We'll do our thing here. Okay, that's great. Well, not to get too verbal too fast from that after that sitting, did anyone have a comment or a question related to the sitting we just did? Yes, please.
I had a question about where music comes in the brain. You know, so it's not where with words associated, just like a tune.
Right. So, well, there's been a growing body of research about music in the brain, and I'm not a specialist in that, but I know something of it. And Oliver Sacks, for example, has published a recent book, I think it's Musicophilia, and he's a great neurologist with a wonderful gift for language. And I'm sure that's a great book. The short answer is that of the two hemispheres, the left, for most people, particularly right-handed people, and probably about half of even left-handed people, the left hemisphere is specialized for sequential processing, whereas the right hemisphere is specialized more for gestalt processing. So the left hemisphere carries the beat of music, whereas the right hemisphere tends to carry the melody. Just as when we're listening to people and we're tracking what's called prosody, or which is the vocal intonations they use. What did you have for lunch today? The rising lilt at the end of a question in English. What are you doing there? You know, has a very different connotation. Prosody. That's carried and that's interpreted primarily in the right hemisphere as well, because that's the melody of human language. Whereas the semantic content is processed much more on the left side.
So, for example, with mantra, could that be a left?
If you're using the mantra, the repetition of that and the production of that internal speech in the mind is produced on the left temporal lobes. And so Broca's area, it's called. It's a little area about the size of the tip of your thumb. So if you stroke out in that area, you can comprehend speech, but you can't produce it intelligibly. Although sometimes people can sing, which is very interesting. They can't talk. It's very interesting. Because, as we'll get to a lot as a recurring theme, neural functions are widely distributed in the brain. Then there's another area called Wernicke's, which is a little further back, another little area about the size of the tip of the thumb that handles comprehension. So Broca's is transmission, Wernicke's is reception. So if your Wernicke's area blows out, you can produce intelligible speech, but you can't really understand what people are saying to you very well at all. So when you're doing a mantra, I suspect what's happening is that the left side is producing the linguistic content repetitively, and maybe even some of the meaning of, like, Om Mani Padme Hum, you know, the jewel and the lotus, jewel of compassion and the lotus of wisdom, and all the rest of that. And whereas the right hemisphere and also the subcortical regions are carrying more of the emotional meaning of that, like the heartfelt associations to the mantra, whatever that might be. So it's a symphony upstairs.
Yeah.
It's not a solo. Very rarely is it just a solo flute or French horn or tuba. Every so often, the tuba blows. That's the amygdala. Look out! You know, that's a big tuba blast, right? but usually it's a symphony, not a soloist. Okay. Anything else maybe about steadying the mind or other things?
Did you just say the Oliver Sacks book again? Musical
musicophilia. What? Philia means love, love of music. Musicophilia. Okay. Any other comments or questions? Maybe especially about steadying the mind? Yeah, please.
Well, first. I really noticed that setting an intention makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
It, no matter what you do, but it sometimes forgets to do that. Before I meditate, and it's so obvious.
Yeah.
And it really does set up a system for you to be able to relax.
Yes.
And steady your mind.
Yeah. You know, of course, in the Noble Eightfold Path, wise intention comes right after wise view. It's really fundamental. Yeah, exactly. Thank you. Yeah.
You've done an analogy yesterday about small drops of water forming, little rivulets forming bigger and bigger, and finally the Grand Canyon. And I have these Grand Canyons I've worked on for years, and, which aren't so helpful. And how does the mind deal with those?
Well, that's a... That's a universal question. It's a very big question, you know, and do you mind giving an example of a particular Grand Canyon, if you would be so personal, and you could slice it however...
Well, I wake up about 3 o'clock in the morning having killed everybody I saw the day before, you know. By 6 o'clock the next morning, they're all alive and well, so... You know, and just it's how to, you know, and it's that, you know, fear, worry kind of thing that you do, you know. And
yeah.
It's repetitive. It took me a long time to realize that I actually hadn't killed all those people. And that, you know, it was just this thing, you know, play that whatever those witching hour, whatever the witching hour does to you. You know, and those other things, I mean, you know, I remember years ago talking to a friend of mine, and we were talking about going into new situations, and I was... saying, you know, when I go to new situations, I never assume that people like me. And he said, oh, that's interesting. I always assume that people like me. And I thought, it's interesting how we've chosen to, you know. But I think, you know, if you play them long enough, and they get to the, you know, show up, and the canyon is already well prepared.
Yeah. Well, that's a... extremely deep and central matter, really. It goes right to the matter, what is practice? And so the way I would reflect on that from really a lot of, you know, 35 years, really, of personal growth activity and also professional activity in that realm. And I don't say that to make myself special. I'd say it more like hard-won lessons from the road. They have a saying in medicine, good judgment comes from experience. And experience comes from bad judgment. So there's a place to appreciate bad judgment, in a sense, and I make some space for it. So I think of it in the framework, let's think of it in the frame of wise effort. We're encouraging the, you know, the creation, the maintenance, and the increase of the wholesome, and we're encouraging the prevention, decrease, and elimination of the unwholesome. So we have two sets of factors, if you will, or forces in the mind. And absent of transcendental, those are forces and factors in the brain. So they're real. They're real patterns of information, which is my working definition for mind, most of which is forever unconscious or unconscious, and much of that is forever unconscious. So we have these, think of them as learned patterns or programs. The computer metaphor is pretty useful here. We have patterns we've learned or programs we've learned or we acquired through our disposition or temperament at birth that help us. And we have patterns we learned or acquired, including disposition at birth, that hurt us. So we want to increase what helps and decrease what hurts. And just starting there is really useful. And also having an attitude of being for oneself. That's incredibly important. You know, yesterday I talked about how vulnerable we are as mammals to learn helplessness, to a felt sense of defeat or futility. And to illustrate that point, I want to describe some of the early animal studies on it, which really, really makes that point. Because the larger takeaway, which is embedded deeply in the Buddhist path, is the sense that everyone can do something at least. to move further along that path toward awakening for their own sake and for the sake of all beings. So it's a path of efficacy. And that said, to go on that path, we really need to be for ourselves, which gets at Anne's question from, where's Anne? Yes, there you are. You were dressed differently, so you confused me. You're wearing your camo gear over there, that shawl. Anyway, about in a context of not self, how do we be for ourselves, in effect? So it's a deep thing to reflect on. So part of what helps one be for oneself is to appreciate how vulnerable we are to not being for ourselves. You know, the AA saying is, the mind is a dangerous neighborhood, don't go in alone. Or I say, you sleep with the enemy every night upstairs. You know, to really appreciate how strong the forces are inside our own mind-brain, you know, system, to obstruct us from being for ourselves in wholesome ways. You know, not Gordon Gekko, greed is good kind of ways, right? But being for ourselves in wholesome ways. So this animal study is very interesting. These were done on dogs before a lot of ethical standards were put in place. And it's telling, and I'll describe it briefly, because for me it's very memorable and it really helps us remember this point. So in this particular series of studies, which were done by a man named Martin Seligman, they have become quite famous, they were basically done in two stages, stage one, stage two. So stage one is the training phase, and then stage two is the sort of results phase. In the training phase, they randomly assigned dogs to two groups, the A group and the B group. And they used dogs because dogs, even though they're dogs, have brains a lot like our own, particularly the emotional and social dimensions of their brains. The more, you know, frontal lobe, you know, parts of the brain they don't have that much of. But dogs are really smart, and of all the species that have ever been studied, they're far and away the best at reading human intention. Like a chimpanzee cannot read, like you can gesture to something that you want, a chimp won't do anything about it. Gesture to something you want, the dog is all over that. They're really tuned into us. So dogs are a lot like us. Okay, so A group and the B group. The training phase works like this, and they have multiple trials in the training phase that are repetitive until the dog is trained. The way it works is like this. They lead the dogs, so they take the A group and the B group, and they match them. So you have the A1, B1 dog, they're a pair. The A2, B2 dog, they're a pair. So they treat them the same way exactly, except for one crucial difference. They march them into a pen. They close the gate. The pen has a metal floor. The pen has a light, a buzzer, and a big switch, shoulder height for a dog. The light goes on, the buzzer starts ringing. Five seconds later, about, bzzz, the floor is electrified. Dogs don't like electrified floors. They freak out, they jump around, they bang eventually on the switch, usually within seconds, and the electricity gets turned off. Okay, that's trial number one. They take the dogs out of the cage, then they lead them back into it. Same thing. And they're identical cages. Maybe they're separated a little bit from each other, but they're identical. Okay? Light goes on, bell starts ringing. 5 seconds later, electrified. Bzz, they hit the switch. Usually within a handful of trials, dogs are smart. They figure out, hit the switch. So the light goes on, the bell starts to ring. They just hit the switch. No electricity. Electricity is prevented. Very good, right? And that's the end of the training phase. The crucial difference between the A group and the B group is that in that B group pen, the switch does not work. Their electricity gets turned off when the A group dog hits his switch or her switch. So they experience exactly the same amount of electricity, the same amount of punishment. And it's not torture, it's just unpleasant. They get the same amount of unpleasant experiencing, but the A group dog has control over their fate. And so they lead them back into the pens a few times just to really reinforce for the A group dog that it has control over its fate. The B group dog doesn't. That's the training phase. Thanks. Got it so far? Okay, we have a lot of compassion for the dogs. Now we move on to the results phase. So now phase two, they lead them into a different kind of pen that's like a long rectangle. And has a barrier in the middle, and it's divided in half, and you can electrify one side or the other. and the barrier is high enough for a dog to jump over, but the dog has to want to jump over the barrier, okay, like a little fence. Right? Same deal. They walk in, they get put on one side of the fence, the light goes on, the bell starts to ring, 5 seconds later the floor is electrified. Bzzzt. The A group dog doesn't like it and, you know, instantly just escapes over the fence. Experiences a few seconds of electricity the first time, but then it's safe on the other side of the little wall. Then they bring them back in. Next time the bell rings and the light goes on, A group dog just hops over the fence. And it's really chill. They're really chill. They lick themselves. They don't care. They're cool. They're in charge of their fate. What the scientists were curious about is how long would it take for the B group dogs to unlearn the training phase? They thought, it would probably take them a little while. It took them forever. In other words, they would just bring them in. They would already start whimpering because they had a sense of defeat and, oh my God, bad things are going to happen to me now. Bring them in, the lights go on, the bell starts to ring. They just whimper and lie there. Floor's electrified. Bzzz. They just lie there. They don't even jump. They don't bother to escape. They're helpless. They've learned to be helpless. This stunned the scientists. So they started to experiment. They removed the fence, the gate, the little wall. The dogs would not walk over a line to get away from electricity, from pain, in other words. Finally, the experimenter said, this is nutso. So they would walk into the cage with rubber boots and gloves and drag the dogs across the line to safety, to safe harbor, to refuge. And they thought, well, I'll do it once. They've got to figure it out. Dogs are bright, right? Self-interest, self-incented. They don't want to be suffering. They don't want to be electrified. It didn't matter. It took dozens, sometimes 100 trials to drag the dog across the line to teach it that it actually had some power over its own fate. The other thing was that they noticed a huge difference between the A group dog and the B group dog. You have to be a little careful about anthropomorphizing. That's a blip mouthful. But we're, you know, in other words, of attributing human mental states to animals. That said, dogs have emotions. Anyone who's been with dogs, hello? The B group dogs were depressed. They weren't interested in eating. They sure weren't interested in sex. They were mopey. They just really hang dog. They were the dog equivalent. They had canine depression. Whereas the A group dogs were pretty frisky, sparky, upbeat. They had control over their fate. Those are the studies on learned helplessness. Aren't the takeaways incredible? Really profound. I mean, it gives you tremendous compassion for people in the world whose circumstances, through poverty, injustice, oppression, what have you, they've been trained in helplessness. It's what governments do very quickly who want to oppress their people. They train them in helplessness. But it's important to understand how vulnerable we are as humans to helplessness. And why it's therefore so important to unlearn helplessness and learn efficacy over and over and over again. That's like, I'm going to keep going with my response to your question, but that's really a crucial point. Yeah.
I just brought to mind something I read yesterday and today, as a matter of fact, actually related to soldiers in Iraq, stating that if it's God's will, I'll make it through the day. If it's not God's will, I won't. And from what you just said, a lot of that has to do with them, a lot of people's mindset. That God's will, actually, not so much, I think, fatalism, but just that there's a sense, it seemed to me as you're saying that, that we have a sense that, well, no matter what I do, it's actually a power beyond me that will handle that.
Right. Yeah. And of course, you know, different things work for different people. I can imagine for some person, they just have this enormous sense of futility. And so they express it in a sense of fatalism. On the other hand, I think for some people there might be if they have a felt sense of the divine as a benevolent force, it might be a source of refuge to them. You know, so depending on the person. But that said, I think it is illustrative of a lot of what happens for people post-combat, you know, have been traumatized. So to go one step further and then, you know, maybe take a little break and then we'll dive more into the self stuff. Then the question becomes, what to do about these patterns in the mind that we've discerned them and we're for ourselves about them? So then how do we unlearn a negative and learn the positive, as it were? Wise effort. That's wise effort over time. And then we do what's useful to us. And for me, there's some basic keys specific to your particular, the topic you raised, which is a very general one. One is to be skillful with our own temperament. The phrase I used yesterday a lot was neurological diversity. In other words, some people are born, they're more aversive. There's a fundamental dynamic or machinery in the brain that's in pretty much all organisms that have a nervous system. In other words, they're multicellular, so they need to have a way for their sensory apparatuses or apparati or whatever to communicate with their motor apparatus. And then a headquarters starts to develop, which becomes a brain. All right. They need to know whether to approach or avoid. And they've got to make a correct decision dozens of times a day. Do I approach? Do I pull back? You know, do I reach out? Do I pull in? Whether it's a sea anemone, right? A dog or a human being. And how do we know whether to approach? How do we know whether to pull back? Well, we have what's called a feeling tone. You know, a second aggregate in Buddhism, right? The Vedana, the pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral feeling tone. So that's an incredible signal to the brain. Approach the pleasant, you know, and fight or flee from the unpleasant, or freeze and appease the unpleasant, you know, in more social animals. Okay. So some of us are born more aversive. We tend to be people who are very sensitive to unpleasant experiences. My daughter's that way. You know, she's very sensitive to things that are unpleasant. So unfortunately, she finds a fair amount of things that are unpleasant. If that's our disposition, we take it into account, and then we work with it in various ways. And one of the most powerful ways is to help ourselves come to appreciate that a lot of what seems unpleasant is actually not unpleasant. And so we gradually learn that that people are not necessarily against us, right? They're not necessarily threats, which would be an unpleasant experience. And so then we particularly want to absorb lessons, which I talked about as one of the factors where we take in the good, that help train the brain, help increasingly incline the mind toward wholesome mental states, because because we take them in. We make them a part of ourselves, and we experience the rewards in them. See, I think the path of practice, the key to it, is to help ourselves want to do what we don't want to do, but is good for us. So over time, you know, it's easy to do what we want to do, right? That's easy. That's a no-brainer. But to do what we don't want to do, but is actually good for us, because wisdom says that would be good for us, that's the key. So then becomes, how do we do that? See what I mean? That's a great skill, isn't it? How do I help incline my mind toward what's good for me, but I don't want to do? Like, I should stop drinking, but I don't want to stop drinking. I should stop forming cases in my mind about other people, you know, and what and who they are and how they're bad and how they've mistreated me and done me wrong, you know, and what I'm going to do about it, right? Case making. Like, I should drop that. But how do I help myself do that? One great way is to really start rewarding ourselves for doing what's wholesome, rewarding ourselves for wise effort. So we try to, increasingly, the brain basically is kind of simple. Carrot, you know, it chases, it's like dangling a carrot before the donkey. You know, the being holds the carrot before the mind. Right? The being holds the reward before the mind, and the mind goes after the carrot. And so what you want to do increasingly is identify rewards for the wholesome path, and then soak in those rewards. So after a number of trials, right, repeated experiences of a reward, usually just a handful of trials, certainly a few dozen, you're in a new direction now. You've carved a new gully through multiple raindrops of trials, of rewarding raindrops, sweet raindrops, nectar from the sky. Now we're going to go increasingly in that direction because we've really taken it in and woven it into the fabric of our brain and ourself. That's a powerful self-help practice that is achievable and doable a few times a day in usually small ways. Those little things, you know, that increasingly become part of ourselves within a few weeks, let alone a few months, and certainly within a few years, we're really moving in a different direction. That's a good start on that one. That's a good start. And what I love about that is I believe it. You know, it's just real to me. It's not airy-fairy. I see the reward in front of my nose that it goes better if I go this way. I feel better. Life goes better. It's here and now, right now. And I believe that it's soaking into me because neurons that fire together, wire together. That was our chant. We're going to do like a rap song, neurons that fire together. Anyway, and I'm building neural structure that's increasingly inclining me in that direction.
Because there's evidence that they unfire together with disuse?
Exactly right. They really do. Neural circuits, there's this phrase called neuronal pruning or neural selection that synapse circuits, call it that, patterns in the nervous system that form and then disperse. But if they're not used, they tend to not activate. Metaphor for me is gardening. You know, we're planting flowers which gradually crowd out the weeds. And in the language of the Buddha, we're starving the weeds of the nutriments. We're not giving them nutriment anymore. The thing is, when we run these little mini movies in the simulator upstairs of what I could have, should have said, how they done me wrong, what I'm going to do, what's bad about that, how I can't do it, whatever. You're running that little mini movie, those neurons are firing. And if they're firing, they're wiring. A little bit each time, but it adds up over time. So which are we going to do? You know, are we going to feed the weeds or are we going to feed the flowers? The Buddha said, feed those flowers, starve those weeds. Sometimes you don't even have to hack away at the weeds. A lot of the practice, it's so interesting. There is a famous sutta, you may know it. I think it's the removal of unwholesome thoughts, where he really talks about more aggressive approaches. But mostly the focus is on the positive. Isn't that wonderful? He doesn't say you need to do, you know, he doesn't say go after the weeds, go after the weeds, go after the weeds. He just says, you know, adopt precepts where you're not enacting the weeds anymore, right? You're not lying, you're not using, you're not killing, you're not stealing, you're not harming people with sex, yourself and others, right? Don't just kind of, just get out of the weeded part. And definitely be very cautious about feeding those weeds with greed and hatred, you know? And increasingly grow flowers, fertilize those flowers, turn toward the wholesome, turn toward Sangha, turn toward, you know, as Ananda and the Buddha talked about, you know, the whole of the holy life, not just half the holy life. Intimacy, love, other people, you know, wisdom, understand the Dharma, turn toward the Dharma, take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, or any other refuges that work for you, like reason, or your pet, or your garden, or the beautiful flower arrangement you made today, right? That's a path of practice. That's a path of with heart we can do every single day.
So how about hypnosis?
Sure. I just wanted to catch someone else if they had a question. Well, hypnosis is a method. It's a very direct way to reprogram the brain. And I think that it's very useful in some ways. EMDR is a very powerful method. That stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. You're a therapist, I think, right? Or you know about this stuff. But it's where you move your eyes fast back and forth. It kind of replicates rapid eye movement in dream sleep, and when you move your eyes back and forth, you're alternately activating the two hemispheres, which promotes kind of things to sort of sort out. You know, arguably trauma is incomplete learning. It's like there was some natural adaptive response that was interrupted and was unable to complete itself. So by doing this EMDR, you're helping the brain complete on that. You know, but sure, there are a lot of skillful means. Arguing against illogical thoughts. You know, we have this thought arise. And one great thing is to label it. My inner labeler is Worm Tongue, because I'm a big fan of Lord of the Rings. You know, I love the books. I love the movie. They're great. And if you know the books or you saw the movie, Worm Tongue. I think Worm Tongue also is like the press secretary for North Korea. Our people love to eat grass. We have cookbooks, grass, 93 ways, you know, right. As soon as you label, that's Worm Tongue talking. You know what to do. My teacher, Adi Da, had a metaphor. He said, you know, let's say you're hanging out and you see this bag. It's this big kind of, you know, grocery bag, kind of brown grocery bag. And it's got grease stains on the side and it's full, kind of brimming and stuff in it and flies are kind of buzzing around it. You know, what is it and what do you do with it? It's a garbage bag. You throw it out. As soon as you know what it is, you know what to do. As soon as you go, Worm Tongue, thank you for sharing. Do you have anything new to say? Okay, I got that. Anything else? I heard that already.
One more chance. Come on. Anything new? Come on. Come on. Heard that too? Shut up. Move on. You recognize that. That right there is key. That's the press secretary for North Korea. Oh, I know what they're going to spin me today. That's my internal worm tongue. You know, if someone came to your face and basically, I'm going to use an earthy term, just looked you right in the eye and just started bullshitting you about how you were messed up and your life opportunities were limited and the future was going to suck and the resources in your life were pretty funky and not that great, right to your face, what would you do?
Go the other way.
Go the other way. Some of the more aggressive of us might do something more as well before we turned around and walked away. Well, hey, who's doing that to your face every day? Mostly in the background of the mind where it's really hard to track. Those kind of softly whispering, just like worm tongue. Psst, 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 psst. Can't do anything. Psst, 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 psst. They're bad. Psst, 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 psst. You're bad. Psst, 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 psst. As soon as you label it as worm tongue, you know what to do. Garbage, take it out. That right there is a huge breakthrough. And then to take it one step further, to really kind of help yourself with that, you can argue against it in a structured kind of way. And that's where some of the techniques of modern psychology are very useful, like cognitive techniques. One of the most powerful cognitive techniques is very simple. You just take a piece of paper, draw a line down the middle of the page, label one column, wrong thought. Label the other column, right thought. Or whatever label you like, that's kind of direct. And put the wrong thought there, a belief, one belief, like, people are going to hurt me, or people are bad, or I'm bad, or anything like that. And then have three or more true rebuttals on the other side. Like you have a good advocate inside your head. You know, like when Worm Tongue was whispering to Theoden in Lord of the Rings, Gandalf came along, he didn't buy any of it. He didn't try to argue against, he argued against Worm Tongue a little bit, but he just knew it was Worm Tongue. He just said, bam, 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 get out of here. It's kind of like that. You want an internal, whoever it is, you know, some good lawyer inside your head who's on your side. That's why being for yourself is so important. Argues against those wrong thoughts.
I was curious to know, since you know all this and have a daughter who tends to be aversive by nature, has any of this worked for her?
Well, on tape, I'm not going to be too personal about that, for her sake and mine. Well, I think the short answer is absolutely. Okay. You know, and... And I think the art a lot in life is that middle way where we, or like that, I think the middle way is the good grandparent way, where we're kind to ourselves, but we also are continually pulling ourselves or encouraging ourselves to the next step. And I think of teaching a child to swim. There's that just right distance. I think the greatest Dharma story of all time is the Goldilocks and the Three Bears, right? Not too hot, not too cold, just right. Not too tall, not too short, just right. Not too hard, not too soft, just right. It's that middle way. We go for that. We find that sweet spot, which dials up or dials down sometimes depending on how tired we are. Do we have the flu? Have we had a rocky day at work? Do we have to put our pet down, you know, recently? Or whatever is up or down. But that sweet spot where, just like when you're teaching someone to swim, you want to keep your fingers a few inches away from their hand. So it's not so far away that they give up and just start sinking, or where you're holding them up and they don't learn to swim on themselves, by themselves. That's what we want to do with our own mind, right? Our own disposition here. So if we have by tendency a fearful disposition, or we have by tendency an aggressive disposition, or a melancholy disposition, those are kind of the big three commonly, we're both kind to ourselves. We don't overburden that disposition beyond what it can handle. We don't get too far away from the kid who's learning to swim. That's too much. That's not skillful. We don't ask too much. I think sometimes we ask too much of ourselves. Sometimes we ask too much of other people. Right? Some of us ask too little, some of us ask too much. I've tended to err on the side of asking too much. So that's where my correction factor has been. That's what we're constantly doing, riding a bike, right? You're constantly falling one way or another, but you're continually correcting. Same in relationships. We're continually repairing. You know, rust never sleeps. You know, entropy is alive and well in relationships as well. In other words, where things continually happen to snip the fabric of a marriage or a relationship. If we're not continually re-knitting, connecting, if we're not continually fertilizing those flowers, they tend to wither away, right? So same with our own tendencies. We don't want to ask too much of ourselves, but on the other hand, we want to keep challenging and pulling. So that would be a way to put it. Why don't we take a formal break rather than the de facto breaks we've had and come back really quickly, okay? How about around 10 minutes? And then we'll dive more into brain and self, okay? Great. One second. Let me just see if I can turn this off.